Bob and Bob One had shown up as well. I gathered from conversation that he'd been harassing Bill for years about the androids. "It worked," I said. "It was a controlled environment, and everyone there was expecting me, of course. I don't know about going out in public. But it's a start, and a successful one." Bob was nodding his head repeatedly. I wondered for a second if his avatar had gotten stuck in a loop, but no, that was just excitement. I accepted the inevitable and settled into my chair for the debriefing. "But how did it feel?" Bill fairly glared at me with the intensity of his question. I had a momentary image of him reaching down my throat and ripping the answer out of me. I snickered, which got me a couple of concerned looks. Compared to VR? I looked up for a moment, organizing my thoughts. "It's an order of magnitude more real. I don't know how much of that is psychological, just from knowing that it is real, but I think the VR only provides the sensations we've programmed it to provide, while Manny gives us everything, expected or not, relevant or not, and not under our control. Think of it as the difference between trying to tickle yourself versus being tickled by someone else. It's an entirely different, far more intense experience." "Yeah," Bill responded. "I tried to get some of that back with the baseball games, but I think it still falls short. Don't get me wrong, Bill. It's not like I expect us to all fall over and go crackers. The VR saved Bob One, and it saved all of us. We all agree on that." I shrugged. "But it's not the full-on experience. We've forgotten what that's like. Today just reminded me." I looked at Bob, who had finally gotten the head bobbing under control, but was now bouncing on his toes. An arched eyebrow made him blush and stop the motion. "I think the android project should be bumped up in priority," Bob said. Bill rolled his eyes. "There's a surprise. You willing to help? You have the free time, right?" Bob looked abashed, and Bill winced at the unintentional cheap shot. "Sorry, buddy. Didn't mean that the way it came out." Bob shrugged. "I get it. And yeah, I do have a lot of free time these days. Maybe this will help." Bill popped up the project notes and schematics, probably rushing to change the subject. Garfield moved in, and the conversation went all technoid. I sighed, stood and waved to everyone, then popped back to my VR. I had some thinking of my own to do. 70. Conversation. Howard, May 2211, HIP-14101. Bridget's voice sounded tired. She was looking better, though, at least over the phone. Her color was coming back. She was starting to take care of herself again. I ached to say something, to take her hand, to... Okay, I needed to cut off that train of thought. I silently chanted ephemeral a half dozen times. It didn't help.
"But it wouldn't be me, would it, really?"
Bridget's image in the video window smiled. Her sad smile was a pale ghost of the high-wattage grin that I remembered from better days. I swallowed and, after a false start or two, replied, "That's a philosophical argument that I freely admit I'm not able to be objective about. I'm not original Bob. I'm not even Bob One, or Will, or Charles. But I'm me, and I feel just as alive as original Bob did." I stood up and began to pace around my apartment. The image that Bridget's phone displayed to her would, of course, stay centered on me. "It would be you in very real ways, Bridget. I don't know from souls, but in every other way you would live on."
"I mentioned the idea casually," Bridget said after a moment of silence. "The girls looked horrified. Even Howie looked unsure. And you know he's all about you and the other Bobs."
I smiled in response. Bridget's son was certainly my biggest fan. I hesitated before continuing. "Look, Bridget, it's not like any decision is irrevocable, except the one that's in force, if and when. I checked with Benning. All you need to do is have her record a video call where you state your wishes. It counts as a codicil. You can record a new one any time."
"I know, Howard. And for the moment, at least, I'll have to pass."
I sighed, defeated.
"Okay, Bridget. But I'm still going to build the equipment.
At least we don't have to behead and freeze you nowadays. The stasis pods will do a much better job of preservation. And the scanners are pretty straightforward. Plus, it's not necessarily just you. We could... I stopped abruptly as a thought hit me. I cued it for consideration after the call. Bridget looked at me with an arched eyebrow, but I didn't explain, so she dropped it.
I hope you won't be upset at me for this, Howard. I still want you to visit now.
Of course not. It's your decision, Bridget, and I'll respect that. And yes, I'll visit when I can. I gave her an apologetic shrug. Manny is getting a makeover right now. Bob One is insanely OCD when he's motivated, no surprise to anyone, and he's been improving the android tech at a furious pace. I chuckled. Bill admitted to me that he's a bit embarrassed. He worked on the project for decades, and Bob's leaving him in the dust in a time span of months.
So, Manny will be a little more human next time I see you?
Actually, Manny will look like original Bob, from what I'm told. Believable hair and skin, and so forth. And he'll be able to eat, although he won't...
Never mind. TMI, she really didn't need to know the ultimate fate of the meal.
Bridget laughed. She knew exactly where my mind had gone. Just one of the many things I loved about her.
So we can finally have dinner together.
I smiled and nodded. Finally. A real date. Butterworth? Bill stared at me, eyebrows climbing his forehead. Well, granted, Riker will probably have a cow, which will be ironic, but Butterworth has got to be in his 80s now, if not more. The guy's like an Egyptian mummy. He just gets drier and more leathery. Maybe he's a pack protector? Bill grinned at me. I rolled my eyes. Honestly, sometimes the early generation Bobs were a bit weird. Yeah, anyway, he's military, or ex-military, whatever. Maybe he can help with the war. Interesting thought, Howard. I'm not against it by any means. We should run it through a moot before bringing it up with Butterworth, though. I nodded, unfazed. Moots were held weekly these days, because of the other's threat. I wouldn't have to wait long. I'd never seen Butterworth actually speechless before. I'd seen him trying not to explode. I'd seen him explode. I'd listened to him explode. This was new. Butterworth stared into the video window, his jaw hanging slightly open. Finally, he found his voice.
You want to replicate me?
Well, eventually, not like this week. The process can't be done on a living person, not if you want to be left with a living person afterwards, but I'm building the equipment for any such circumstance, and it occurred to me that you would be valuable for the war effort. Butterworth looked down at his desk in silence. Then he looked up and smiled.
Sure, why not?
Well, that was easy. Okay, I'll send you a file with some information. You'll need to update your will. Butterworth nodded and ended the call. 71. Charlie. Bob. June 2213, Delta Eridani. Charlie hung in the rack, powered down and looking boneless. The Deltan android looked utterly convincing. I had put a lot of effort into getting the fur right, both in texture and layout. I didn't want Charlie to come across like all the bad ape and werewolf costumes from 20th century movies. This needed to be believable. I realized that I was stalling. The android had been checked out every which way, and it was now time to put up or shut up. Sighing, I ordered the cargo drone to open the hangar door while I activated Charlie. I turned my head and looked out the cargo bay doors. It took a moment for my eyes to adjust to the bright daylight outside. I undraped myself from the support rack and, staggering a little, walked to the doors. I stood for a moment looking around at the forest. I'd seen all of this many times, of course, from the various drones, but there was something viscerally different this time. I was here in some undefinable way. It might be as simple as the feeling of the breeze lightly ruffling my fur, or the smell of the damp leaf layer that formed the floor of the forest. I spared a moment to grin with unconstrained joy, which the autonomic interface converted to a spread-eared, wide-eyed expression appropriate to a Deltan.
Stepping out onto the surface of Eden, I looked down at the ground, feeling the slightly slimy texture as the decaying leaf fragments squished between my clawed toes. Dappled sunlight flickered as the tree branches and leaves moved in the breeze. With an effort, I brought myself back on task. I triggered the heads-up display and pulled up a local map. The image hovering in my line of sight showed my location and the location of Archimedes relative to me. I turned to line him up and began to walk. I spotted Archimedes through the underbrush, the observation drone hovering near his shoulder. He casually worked a small flint core as he waited. It appeared I was far more nervous about this meeting than he was, or maybe that was his way of coping. Well, whatever. Showtime. I walked towards him and said his name as soon as I was within conversational distance. He looked up, and his eyes went wide. Springing to his feet, he squeaked,
"Bob!"
I grinned at him as I approached. I opened my mouth to respond, but stopped in surprise when he jerked back and exclaimed,
"Woof! Wow!"
"Problem?"
"Sorry, Bob. You smell. Kinda like the drones, especially when a new one is delivered. And also a bit like the ashes from a cold fire. You definitely won't fool anyone."
"Oh, crap." I rolled my eyes in frustration. "I didn't think of that. Deltans depend much more on the sense of smell than humans do. Is it really bad?"
"Not as long as I'm upwind, no."
He grinned at me. "Gotcha. Okay, I'll go to work on it. How about the rest? Does it look okay?" Archimedes cocked his head one way, then the other.
"You move in a sort of jerky way, like a pup when he's learning to walk. But maybe that'll go away. What's more weird is that your fur pattern is exactly the same on both sides of your body. No one is like that. It stands out."
Of course, I'd made Charlie completely symmetrical. I would have to fix that. And the odor. I needed to smell like a Deltan, and more importantly, like an individual. I took a deep lungful of Archimedes, cataloging his odor and the lingering essence of what had to be Diana. It wasn't insurmountable, thank the universe, just chemistry. "Got it. Okay, Archimedes, I'll go away and fix this stuff. I can see you trying to stay upwind of me, even though you're being polite about it," I chuckled. "Having been downwind of a couple of people who needed showers in a former life, I can relate." Archimedes looked slightly confused, but nodded. I waved goodbye and turned to walk back to the cargo drone. Charlie the Android, take two. I walked up to Archimedes and spread my arms, palms forward, in a "well" gesture. He took a deep sniff, cocked his head, and nodded.
"You're walking better as well. I guess that's just practice, like with children. And your fur pattern is better. It's very simple, but I know a few people like that. You'll just be forgettable."
He grinned at me. I laughed in response. "Well, that's fine. The last thing I want is to attract attention. Now, will I be questioned if I enter Camelot?"
"No, I don't think so."
Archimedes turned and gestured towards the village, and we began walking. I silently ordered the drone to return to standby.
"Camelot is so big now," he continued. "And Caerleon is growing as well, even with the tension between us and them. A certain number of people still move back and forth. It's not like there are rules about it."
He gave me a sideways glance and a knowing grin. I pantomimed silent laughter at him. Archimedes and I had talked about many things over the decades. I think he now understood that I wasn't some kind of supernatural being, just someone with more knowledge than him. In a society where very little changed from generation to generation, it was easy to think of the way things are as some kind of natural state, but Archimedes had seen enough new knowledge in his lifetime to understand that when you went from not knowing something to knowing something, it changed the way you lived. With the loss of that awe had come a much deeper friendship and a better understanding between us. Archimedes thought a lot of the things humans took for granted were hilarious, like the idea of rules for everything. Deltans simply wouldn't stand for such regimentation of their lives. I found myself coming around to his point of view more and more. In short order, we arrived at Camelot. With an effort of will, I suppressed the Monty Python skit from my mind. As we walked across the land bridge, I looked ahead at the village proper. It was a sea of Deltons, in groups around the central fires, and smaller groups around individual fire pits. I could see Archimedes's point. No one would be able to keep track of this many people. Really, based on the old definition of a village where everyone knew everyone else, this could be thought of as an unhealthy development. Caer Leon wasn't much better. I wondered if the Deltons had a higher tolerance for crowding, or if they had developed a reluctance to split off villages because of the gorilloid and hippogriff threats. I resolved to bring it up with Archimedes, when time permitted. We moved toward Archimedes's Hexki. There I saw Diana, Buster, Belinda, and a couple of generations of children around the fire. Buster's siblings had long since moved on to their own fire pits, but Buster had stayed close with his father. I was glad of that. So, Diana. I was unreasonably nervous. Really, how could she associate me with the Bob? I appeared to be some random Delton. Just the same, I couldn't shake it. We sat down at the fire, and Archimedes introduced me to the adults using a common Delton name, which I instructed the translation routine to render as Robert. I performed the proper earwaggle greeting to each. Diana didn't even twitch, and I relaxed. I noted that Diana was looking old and frail. It confirmed my feeling that Archimedes was aging more slowly than average. Probably the same gene responsible for his increased intelligence was affecting his lifespan. I felt a moment of relief that she might be gone soon, then a spike of shame at the thought. I might not like her, but she was Archimedes' life mate, and he was my friend. The kids? I realized with a shock that these were Buster's grandchildren, had started a game of tag while the adults talked, and one of them barreled into me. There was a moment of tense silence, then I laughed and poked the child with a finger. The tension dissolved, and Diana passed around some jerky. Just family. 72. Battle. Bill, February 22, 2017, Delta Pavonis. All warfare is based on deception. Sun Tzu, Art of War. The defensive crews were less than a week away from Delta Pavonis, and their Tau was now down to the point where it was worthwhile having a conversation. Rather than asking them to jack up to our time rate, we would be slowing down to theirs. Because of the numbers, I was hosting the meeting in the Moot VR. First and most significant, I said, is that we've cracked the cloaking tech. It took a lot longer than I expected, so Jacques has only been able to retrofit about half of his nukes. There's no time for you to do anything, so all the non-stealth hardware, including Bob's, is going to be considered decoys. I looked around the room at a sea of somber faces. We'd all gone into this with the attitude that it was probably a suicide mission. With remote backups, suicide missions weren't as final as they used to be, but still, the person restored from a backup was not the person who created the backup. It was some comfort to know that your memories would go on, but it didn't feel that it would be personal in some way. I glanced at the status window that I had put up. It showed the others' armada only 2 days farther out. We had very little time to deploy a defense. "How are we doing this, then?" asked Andrew, one of the squad leaders. I nodded to him, acknowledging the question. "I've discussed strategy with Butterworth. Unfortunately, most space battle strategy is theoretical since there's only been one space war, but I discussed options extensively with him, and the colonel did have some suggestions about deployment. He can't be personally involved, of course, since he operates on biological time. For what it's worth, I'll be acting as his proxy." There were silent nods around the circle. I added arrows and icons to the status window. "Your group is coming in from this side, and Jacques' group will be coming in from here and here. We'll hit in three waves, staggered, so we're not taking each other out. Hopefully the others can't redeploy defenses quickly enough, and we'll have to split their assets into three groups instead." The animation in the window played out a visual of my description. "While the others are fending us off, the stealth bombs will come straight in. We hope that they will be able to get in close and do some significant damage. I sat back, chin in hand, and studied the graphic. There was no subtlety at all. On the other hand, it was nice and simple, with a few unknowns. The first attack group was 5 minutes out when the others registered their presence. The group's trajectory brought them in at 30 degrees off of their approach line. I could see in the Sudar window that the others were deploying drones to act as a first wave of defenders. There wasn't enough detail at that distance to be able to tell, but we assumed they were rotating the death asteroids to target us as well. There was very little conversation as we approached. Each Bob presumably took the time to make peace with his own thoughts. Or update his backup. Either or. At about 3 minutes distance, there was a whoop from one of the dreadnoughts. "Just took a hit from a death ray," he announced. "I got sparks, but no significant damage." I smiled, but didn't comment. At this distance, even a version 3 Heaven vessel would have survived. We had to assume they were either massively overconfident or that had been just a probe of some kind. At least one death asteroid was now discharged. It was unlikely it would be able to recharge in time to participate further in this battle. At 1 minute, I activated the general channel. "Time to rock, boys. Deploy all busters and nukes. Let's light up the sky." The Bobs did as ordered. 75 ships became almost 400 signatures. Now the others would have to react. Death zaps would simply not be an option for taking us down. And sure enough, Sudar indicated a massive rearrangement of vessels. We had a couple hundred drones to deal with. Statistically, we should be able to get through the defenders with about half of our units, but that wouldn't be enough to take the others' main vessels down. I was sure the others must be smiling, or whatever they did, with glee at our pathetic showing. And finally, contact. Andrew's group was the first to pass through the others' armada. At the speeds they were traveling, there was no chance of any actual visual contact. Star Wars notwithstanding, ships didn't buzz around each other like World War II fighter planes. Everything happened in microseconds and showed up only in status windows. Results from the first pass showed we'd lost about half of our busters and bombs and 8 dreadnoughts, but we'd taken out about twice as many of them. That was pretty good, and should wipe the smile equivalence off the others' face equivalence. Apparently the others agreed because half of the death asteroids released zaps at our armada. "Report," I ordered on the general channel. Responses came back. No further Bob casualties, although a couple of the dreadnoughts were doing emergency repairs. They must have been caught square in the middle of a beam. However, the bombs and busters weren't particularly shielded, and any unit caught anywhere in one of the death rays was dead. We had made a decision, based on this likelihood, to equip these units with regular radio comms only. No advanced Sudar, no scut, and no chance of giving anything away to the enemy. The second wave came in right away, not giving the others time to regroup. They approached from 30 degrees off the others' flight line as well, coming in from a vector at 120 degrees of rotation. I watched in the status window transmitted by the group leader. The second wave passed through the others' armada as quickly as we had, but with much less organized resistance from the others. We were able to put several nukes into a couple of big cargo carriers and even into one of the death asteroids. The nuke must have hit a charged accumulator of some kind because the pyrotechnics were truly epic, far more than could be accounted for by a low-yield fission bomb. Twin jets of white-hot plasma glowing right into the X-ray band shot out of the vessel in opposite directions. The surface of the death asteroid peeled back, then it completely disintegrated, spewing pieces in all directions. Cheers went up from all the video windows. The others responded with a volley of something, possibly drones, possibly missiles, aimed at the receding attack group. The bogeys displayed truly incredible acceleration. In the hundreds of Gs. It took only moments for us to find out what they were. Fusion bombs. The second battle group had been clustered together, no reason to scatter as far as they knew. Now they were melted slag. We'd lost 25 dreadnoughts and a couple hundred drones. Bobs looked at each other, stunned. But our third battle group was coming in and we had no time to mourn. I sent a quick IM to the group leader, instructing them to scatter at the end of their pass. The others started moving their defenses to the point a further 120 degrees around where they expected us to come in, given a symmetrical series of assaults, exactly what Butterworth had suggested they'd do. Our third group came in only 10 degrees off the first group's path, 130 degrees away from where the defenses were forming, completely blindsiding them. The dreadnoughts and drones tore through the defenders like tissue paper. Lobbed fission weapons took out 2 cargo vessels and another death asteroid. As the battle group exited the theater on the far side, they scattered. The others launched another volley of fusion drones in pursuit. The Bobs had a massive head start, but the pursuers had that ridiculous level of acceleration. It was a foot race we couldn't win. Everyone was intent on the developing drama, which left the door open for Butterworth's next suggestion, a trio of lonely nukes on ballistic trajectories with virtually no emissions now sailed in from the vector from which the others had been expecting the third attack. 3 flashes and 2 more cargo vessels were drifting, offline. I imagine somewhere in one of the death asteroids, some other's general was screaming invective at his subordinates while veins pulsed on his neck and forehead. Or some equivalent. In any case, the others apparently decided to finally take us seriously. A massive series of Sudar pings emanated from their fleet, swamping our receivers. The transmission power was truly incredible, and my jaw dropped at the readings. I looked at one of the other Bobs. The sheer power behind that broadcast said, better than anything else they'd done, that we were gnats. And more to the point, it lit up every vessel and drone in the immediate area. Whether it would reveal our last surprise or not? Well, we'd know in a few moments. It did. The others launched a 12 fusion drones straight forward along their flight line where several cloaked fusion bombs were approaching. This would have been our coup de grace. Instead, it would be little more than a parting shot. I instructed the incoming nukes to begin evasive maneuvers. The others might not be able to maintain a continuous bead on the cloaked units. The others' fusion drones deployed into a defensive grid and detonated simultaneously. Not bad, Charlie said. They estimated that pretty well. I checked status. They took out 2 of ours. The last one still looks operational. I don't think they have time to do anything about it. It's also interesting that they haven't broadcast another ping like the last one. Like the gamma ray blasts, it probably requires a recharge. I nodded distractedly while I guided the last cloaked fusion weapon right into one of the death asteroids. It detonated perfectly. When the flash cleared, there was nothing left but scattered debris. We were done. We'd used up everything we had. Our battle groups, what was left, were heading away from the others' fleet at far too high a velocity to be able to turn around in any reasonable interval. By the time we could get back in the game, the others would be at the PAV home planet. 8 death asteroids and 11 cargo carriers were still under power. If they decided to continue on and rebuild in the system, there would be nothing we could do. We held our breath as the seconds ticked by. No change. I sat, stunned, as the others continued on towards Delta Pavonis and the Pavs. We'd failed.
Incoming message in Mandarin.
I was almost doubled over with nausea, but it was logical to find out what they had to say. Put it on, Guppy.
You have proven to be more than food. You are pests. We will harvest this system despite your pathetic attempts at defense. Then we will harvest your Sol and Epsilon Eridani systems, and your species will end its existence in our larders.
Fuck. I tried to open a chat with Jacques, but got nothing. I pinged Andrew instead. Hey, Andrew, any idea where Jacques is?
Hey, Bill, sorry. Jacques was killed during his group's attack. We have a differential up to the last few minutes, so we'll be restoring him as soon as we have a new vessel.
Crap. I rubbed my forehead. We had some spare matrices, but it could still be days before we were able to get that done. Andrew interrupted my train of thought.
Did he ever follow through on that plan to kidnap some PAV?
Yeah, kind of a worst-case response. I've triggered implementation already. We'll get 20,000 PAV off-planet before the others get there. We're not going to be gentle about it, though. We can't afford to have a discussion and ask for volunteers. The PAV were now an endangered species. I just hoped that Jacques had taken plant and animal specimens and such. 73. Collection. Phineas, February 2217, Delta Pavonis. I closed the connection with Bill and turned to Ferb. The defense of Delta Pavonis had failed, and we now had to compound the karmic deficit by ripping up to 20,000 people from their homes by force. Jacques had put a lot of thought into the problem, and Ferb and I had expanded on the plan once we'd come online. It wasn't going to be pretty, but there simply wasn't time for explanation and debate. It should have helped that the people we were going to snatch would otherwise die. It didn't. Jacques had selected two towns of the right size in different parts of the target country to maximize genetic diversity while still retaining community. We carried specialist drones in our holds ready to do the deed. I hovered over my town, Major, in the dead of night. If this was Earth, it would be about 3 a.m. A dog barked. Well, the local equivalent of a dog did the equivalent of barking. But otherwise, there was no movement. Without an electrical grid, most places still went totally dark once everyone went to bed. I sent out the first wave of drones. These were equipped with canisters of a heavy, odorless gas that we'd developed. It would render the victims unconscious for up to 4 hours. By then, hopefully, we'd have them all in stasis. The drones performed their task, then headed back to the cargo hold, and the second wave of drones exited to collect bodies. Each drone could hold 2 adult PAV. It would take about 50 trips per drone to collect the full 10,000 people. I hoped that we would come up under 10,000 in total, rather than have to leave people behind. I dreaded what anyone would have to go through, waking up to find that almost everyone in their town had disappeared. It would be devastating, even without the inevitable suspicion that would fall on them. The operation completed flawlessly. Some comments over the scut from Ferb indicated that his end wasn't going quite so swimmingly. I smiled, thinking of the ribbing I'd given. Then I lost the smile when I realized neither of us would be in the mood. I'd emptied the town with a count of 9,273. I checked with Ferb to see what his head count would be like. His town was coming in under as well, so I implemented one of our contingency plans. There were a number of bases within a few hundred miles that housed either standing armies or perhaps some version of peacekeeping forces. I raided 3 of them and brought my total up to within 100 of my maximum capacity. Some military personnel would be worth having. The gas we had used would biodegrade within hours. By the time investigators were brought in, there wouldn't even be an odor, assuming they had time to do that before the others got here. I pinged Ferb. Ready to go? He didn't answer for a few milliseconds. I was just opening my mouth to repeat the question when he responded. Yeah, looks like it. Woo-hoo! I nodded to myself. Yeah. Woo-hoo, indeed. 74. Observing the process. Bill. May 2217, Delta Pavonis. The others ignored us. I wasn't sure if they knew we had nothing left or if they were simply not interested unless we attacked again. But either way, they didn't chase us out of the system or attempt to sweep it for drones. We had a dozen or so stealth drones still in service, so we deployed them to record the harvesting process. This would be the hardest thing I'd ever done, but we needed as much information as possible. The others took a week to set up around Delta Pavonis 4. Then the Death Asteroid started a series of sweeps that eventually covered the entire planet. We couldn't get close enough for a visual, but we knew what was happening. Up to 1 billion sentient beings were being slaughtered to serve as food and to clear the way for efficient mining operations. Over the next several weeks, the others deployed massive printer operations. It was too early to tell for sure, but it looked like at least some of them would be building new cargo vessels. I closed the windows and instructed Guppy to let me know if anything needed my attention. I pinged Jacques and received an invitation to visit. Jacques had had 10 years to prepare for the arrival of the others, and he'd planned accordingly. He had built 2 colony ships adapted for PAV passengers. They now contained 20,000 PAV in stasis. We could keep them in that state for as long as necessary. Eventually, the others would leave. We would attempt to restart the ecology, then we'd decant the PAV. I didn't look forward to that conversation. Jacques had also built several spare matrices and housed them in the colony ships, ready for any casualties of the attack. He probably hadn't counted on being one of those. Now he was a passenger with no ship of his own. Still, with the state of our VR tech and Scut communications, it wasn't a huge disability. More of an inconvenience. I popped in. "Hi, Jacques. How's the life of a passenger?" He shrugged.
"Eh. I'm more of an administrator right now, trying to clean up and organize the surviving bobs and equipment. And do inventory.
Nothing unaccounted for, so we don't have to worry about the others getting Scut or something similar." I waved that away. "I already checked up on that. I'm more worried about the path. Should we consider moving them to another system?"
"I know what you mean, Bill.
Here, they'll be going back to a dead planet. Psychologically, that's going to be devastating. I've got enough seed stock and such to rebuild a basic ecology, but 90% of the planetary diversity is gone for good. So why not another system? Besides the psychological issues, by the time the others are done with it, there'll be no metal left." The others aren't that thorough. They take like 95% of it, but they don't scrabble for every last gram. Still, it will be a problem if the PAV want to rebuild an industrial society. Could we bring in resources from out-system? I sighed and shook my head.
Theoretically, sure, but then we've got another race depending on us, another client race. Do you really want to become an overlord?
Crap. Jacques sat back and rubbed his forehead.
Whatever happened to heading off into the cosmos and exploring?
I distinctly remember that was the plan when Bob One was heading for Epsilon Eridani in the first place.
I know.
No one to answer to, no responsibility except to ourselves. Maybe we'll get back to that eventually. Right now, though, we've got all these problems, and we can't just walk away.
Yeah, yeah, Jacques gave me a wry look with one eyebrow raised. Still, Pacino just keeps looking smarter and smarter.
Look, all this is on the agenda for the next moot. It's not going to be a fun meeting. It was not a fun meeting. We had just witnessed the death of somewhere between 500 million and 1 billion people. We Bobs are generally upbeat and optimistic, but this had really kicked the stuffing out of us.
"I keep telling myself that this isn't the first species that they've wiped out," Howard said to the room in general. "But it doesn't help."
"This is the first one that we've witnessed," Tony responded. "It's just more real, somehow." There were nods, followed by a long silence. From the back, a voice muttered, "They need to be exterminated." The crowd muttered agreement. I looked in the general direction of the voice. That's a significant decision. Nonetheless, I'm not inclined to argue. Let's wait a couple of days to let our emotions die down, then take a vote.
"Leaving outstanding," Thor said. "The small detail of exactly how we're going to do that."
This comment produced another long silence. No one was really in the mood for deep thought. We'd save this subject for another day. I orbited over Ragnarok, watching listlessly through my forward camera as the planet turned beneath me. After the moot, I'd had some idea of working on my current android, but I couldn't even get up the energy to do that. Funny, since Bob One had woken up in New Handletown all those years ago, we'd always seemed to be on top of things. Yeah, there were dangers, there were scary times. I remembered being unsure of whether I'd come out alive in the encounter with Medeiros. And I also remembered being almost unsurprised when he went down. This was the first time that we had completely, unutterably failed at something. This was a total rout. There was no way to wring a moral victory out of it. And worse, I didn't see any way to turn it around. I watched Bullseye slide across my view as I passed that section of the planet. The crater was now a freshwater sea, with a central island. Okay, that was kind of a failure, too. The others had brushed us aside like fleas. They'd stated their intention to hit Earth, and if we tried to stop that, they'd probably just brush us aside again. There was no way that Will was going to be able to get everyone off Earth before the others arrived. Not even a significant fraction. We might, if we threw everything into it, be able to get a couple million out of the way, but no more. And that would only delay the inevitable. The others were coming, and coming to all the possible homes of humanity. We were an endangered species as long as they continued to exist. Garfield popped in, and we exchanged a few words. He wasn't in any better mood. There would be no cheering up happening here today, not by anyone. He sat and watched the video window with me. The time passed, almost unfelt. Eventually Bullseye came around and slid across my view again, mocking me with this visible reminder of my fallibility. Nothing like a couple hundred thousand tons of ice to make a dent in a planet. Nothing like a couple hundred thousand tons. I sat up abruptly, frowning. Garfield glanced sideways at my unexpected movement. Maybe we'd been looking at this all wrong. 75. Reunion. Howard, January 2216, HIP 14101. Wow, and I thought the stage fright was bad last time. I'd been staring at the inside of the cargo door for what felt like forever. By this time, Bridget would have given up and gone to bed. I checked the time. 3 seconds elapsed. Oh, for... With a feeling akin to resignation, I ordered the door to open and walked out of the cargo bay. Bridget stood on her porch, waiting. She gave me a smile and a small, aborted wave as I turned in her direction. I walked toward the patio, cataloging all the sensations I was receiving from Manny. The cool evening breeze, the slight unevenness of the front walkway, the brush of my clothing as I moved, and the disappearance of every inch of distance as I approached her, like falling down a gravity well. Finally, after a million years or so, I walked up the two wooden steps, stopped in front of her, and held out my hands. She took them and said,
"You're looking good, Howard."
I smiled. I'd checked in the mirror a few dozen times, and the smile looked normal, and replied, "It's nice to see you again." Bridget would be 57 by now, physically. She'd stopped dyeing her hair and was showing her natural gray. She had crow's feet around her eyes and an incipient double chin. I quite literally couldn't have cared less.
76. Funeral.
Bob, November 2220, Delta Eridani. I stood to one side as Archimedes hugged with Buster and his siblings, Rosa and Pete. Diana had died overnight, peacefully, thank the universe. Deltons didn't cry as such, but their equivalent was just as heart-wrenching. Diana was laid carefully into the grave, then Archimedes and his children each placed one white flower in her arms. As they stepped out of the way, the long lineup of descendants filed past and added more flowers. Diana and Archimedes had done quite well with spreading their genes. When the lineup was finished, 31 flowers formed a large bouquet in her embrace. The family filled in the grave, then placed several large stone slabs over it to protect it from scavengers. When it was done, everyone but Archimedes stepped back. He slowly sank to his knees, leaned forward, and hugged himself. Uttering a low keening, Archimedes rocked slowly back and forth. I popped into VR, shaking and taking deep breaths. Charlie would be fine for a few moments on autonomous control, and I was very close to losing it. I rubbed my eyes savagely, muttered a few curses, then popped back into Charlie. The crowd was slowly dispersing, leaving Archimedes and his children to their mourning. I took the opportunity to look Archimedes over. I had only an estimate of his age from when I first showed up, of course, but I put him at about 70, which put him slightly older than Moses when he passed away. And Moses had been considered ancient. All of which meant that I would probably be attending another funeral soon. I vowed it would be my last.
77. Completion.
Bill, April 2221, Delta Pavonis. It took a little over 4 years for the others to strip Delta Pavonis. It was an impressive speed until you realized that exponential behavior was involved. They brought a huge complement of auto factories, which they used to produce equipment which mined resources for the production of more equipment. At some point, they stopped building equipment and started loading the cargo vessels. Finally, they harvested most of the equipment they'd built. The fleet that left the system consisted of only cargo vessels and death asteroids. Once they were gone, we moved in to examine the damage. The asteroid belt and any small moons in the system had been stripped, of course. What really hurt was the state of Delta Pavonis IV. The others hadn't been concerned with ecological damage, obviously. They'd left the planet a dirty ball of mud. All the green had long since faded to a dull brown. The blue of the oceans was replaced by a mottled gray, and the ice caps had either melted or been coated with dust and soot. Every major city had been demolished. The lack of corpses was, in a way, a blessing, but it left a ghostly, empty tableau that would have been completely appropriate to any of 100 post-apocalyptic movies. I took it as long as I could. Then I turned off the video feeds, put my face in my hands, and wept. Jacques agreed that rehabilitation of DP-4 would take a long time, but he quite correctly pointed out that flying the paths to another system far enough away from the others to be safe would possibly take just as long. We had a reasonable candidate. A wandering Bob had found a suitable colonization target at HIP 84051. At more than 40 light-years from Sol, it didn't even rate a name, just a minor designation in the constellation Ara. I popped over to visit Will. Hey, guy, how are you holding up? Riker still wore a haunted look. Homer's suicide had affected him more than anyone would have thought possible. With the perfect memory that being a replicant brought with it, things didn't fade with time. The vengeance that he had extracted had helped some. But there would always be a hole in the Bobiverse. He gave me a small smile. Holding steady, Bill. You hear about HIP 84051-2? At my nod, he continued. It was on the discussion agenda, and when I brought up the circumstances, the UN voted to make it available to the PAV refugees. Honestly, I think it's a little too far from Seoul to be really attractive anyway. I sat down and materialized a coffee and took a moment to look around. Will had long since given up the Star Trek motif, and he was going by his first name. I guess number one's first name, anyway, most of the time now. That was the name that our relatives knew him by, anyway. The VR resembled a housing unit on Vulcan, although I recognized some decor and paraphernalia from original Bob's apartment. I smiled to see the limited edition Spock plaque signed by Leonard Nimoy hanging on the wall. Life just keeps getting more complicated, doesn't it? I raised the coffee in salute. Suppose so. Will stretched, then materialized a coffee of his own. I'm beginning to think Bob One has the right idea. He's been talking about going out again once Archimedes is gone. Just point the ship and accelerate for a while. I sighed and nodded. We were... what, 8 to 10 generations deep in Bob's now? Bob One had achieved a kind of legendary status. He rarely showed up at Moots anymore, and when he did, it was like a Shatner sighting. I felt a deep sympathy for him. He was the first of us to get emotionally involved with ephemerals, and until Jacques and the Pavs, his had had the worst outcome. I understand you're going to wake some Pav and put the question to them, Will said. Yeah. Jacques has an unreasonable attachment to the idea of recolonizing DP-4, in my opinion, but he's rational enough to see it. Will returned one of his rare full-on smiles. Well, Bob, right? We laughed together, and I continued. So we'll give them the choice. Attempt to recolonize DP-4 or head for a new world with an already established ecosystem. And a compatible one, as seems to be the norm. I chuckled. I sure wish I could go back and talk to Dr. Carlyle. I bet he'd be tickled that his theories have been so emphatically vindicated. Will nodded but didn't comment. I sat back, and we sipped our coffees in silence. simply enjoying the company and the momentary pause in existence. The Pav huddled in a corner, whimpering. I'd expected a certain level of fear, but the Pav's reaction bordered on xenophobia. But I doubted the, recruitment had involved a lot of discussion and consent. Kidnapping was a pretty accurate description. The specimen in front of us was probably still traumatized. At that moment, the door to the chamber opened and three more Pav staggered in. They were still suffering from post-stasis confusion, but they reacted in instinctive Pav pack fashion by huddling in a pile with our first candidate. The presence of company seemed to calm her significantly. Over the next few hours, we brought in several more Pav until we had eight of them in the room. The number was arbitrary, but Jacques' investigation of the species had indicated a general maximum of eight adults to a family group. We hoped that it was a significant number for them. When they appeared outwardly calm and had started to compare notes with each other, I decided it was time for official first contact. Hello. All eight Pav went into alert posture. The resemblance to meerkats was even more pronounced than usual, and in better circumstances I would have chuckled at the tableau.
Who are you? Where are we?
This was not going to be easy. My name is Bill. I'm part of BobNet. The translation routine rendered proper names phonetically, but the sounds wouldn't mean anything to them. Who we are is a very long story. Where you are and why is a shorter and very unpleasant story. I described the others to them and explained their habit of raiding systems and killing off planets. A monitor on one wall displayed images of others, the aftermath of Zeta Tucanae, and finally the destruction of Delta Pavonis IV. As the images of dead cities, oceans, and forests flashed on the screen, the path began to keen. Sitting through that was one of the hardest things I'd ever done, but I had a moral obligation to stick with it. It took a few hours, but we finally got through the whole story. The group seemed perplexed.
You want us to decide? To return to ASEAN or settle a different world?
That is correct. The Pav huddled and argued in low voices for several minutes. Hasjar, who seemed to have taken on the role of spokesperson, said,
Why?
Because we don't know you well enough to know what would work best for you.
Why not?
Because we haven't been studying you for long enough.
Why not?
Oh, holy... That's not important. We will make the decision if you don't want to, but we wanted to give you the option first.
And there are 20,000 of us? Why not more?
That's how many will fit into the two ships that we were able to build.
Why?
What are you, a four-year-old? I would have to nip this in the bud before I blew a transistor or something. Again, not important now. Are you willing and able to make that decision? If not, let us know, and we'll take care of it.
We will discuss this. Is there food?
You mean at the new planet? Oh, you mean now. Sorry, I'll get some. Fortunately, Jacques had thought of stocking up on standard Pav food and drink. I decanted a small supply and delivered it. The Pav laid in as if they hadn't eaten in a week. I stared in shock at the free-for-all. So far, no one seemed to have lost a limb, but that could just be luck. Jacques chuckled at the expression on my face. No, that's pretty much normal feeding behavior. Miss Manners would never catch on with these people. I shook my head. Count them after they're done, okay? Make sure there are still eight. At Hasjar's request, we provided images of the proposed colony planet. It possessed a marginally heavier gravity with correspondingly thicker atmosphere, but was similar enough to ASEAN that adaptation wouldn't be an issue. The flora and fauna would be completely unfamiliar to them, of course, but it didn't include anything too large to deal with. We promised the Pav any help they needed, regardless of their decision. They seemed heartened by that, and I privately sighed in exasperation. Again, we were going to be responsible for another client race. If Jacques wanted to be involved, fine, but I resolved to keep my distance.
We will choose the new world.
Hasjar stood tall and spoke with confidence. I knew that the decision hadn't been easy or unanimous, but I was impressed at their willingness to even make a decision. She looked down, then continued in a softer voice.
We do not like the idea of all resources being supplied by you. No offense, but we do not know you.
I grinned at Jacques, who smiled back and shrugged. That's fine, Hasjar. We'll get started right away. It will be necessary to put you back to sleep, but we'll be gentler this time. Hasjar nodded. By coincidence, a nod meant the same thing to the path as it did to us.
When we awake, we will be there?
That's correct. And we will have set up an encampment for you to live in until you can build something for yourselves. Hasjar cocked her head slightly.
I am curious. Why do you do this? Who is paying you, or do you expect us to pay you?
I chuckled, which the translation routine converted to the PAV expression of humor. And a good thing. Who knew how a human chuckle would come across? We don't use money, Hasjar. We have no need for it. This statement produced a look of shock. Apparently capitalism was alive and well in PAV culture. After staring at the monitor for a few more seconds, Hasjar turned away, while muttering something that sounded like Dojagriel. The routine translated it as critters with broken brains. The PAV seemed reluctant to return to the stasis chambers and generally acted like a bunch of kids trying to delay bedtime. Eventually, though, we managed to cajole them all through the door and into the prep room. Within an hour, they were all squared away. Well, Bill, I guess this is it. Not quite yet, Jacques. A couple of the guys did some scavenging. We've managed to retrieve enough resources to put together a couple of version 3s for you and the other Bobs who are bodiless right now. It'll take a few months, but at least then you'll be able to ride escort instead of supercargo. Jacques nodded.
Thanks, Bill. Let's do that.
Finally, departure day. The two refugee ships, officially named Refuge 1 and 2, brought their surge drives up to full power and turned their bows to aim for HIP 84051. I watched their departure from the forward camera of one of the Bobs that was still in system. With the departure of the refugee ships, there was no longer any reason to maintain a presence in this system. It represented our greatest failure, and several Bobs had complained that it felt as though it was full of ghosts. Everyone who didn't have a reason to stay had long since left, and now most of the rest of us would be departing. A couple of eighth-generation Bobs had volunteered to stay behind and do a post-invasion survey. I looked at Andrew across the table, waiting for him to speak. Finally, he took a deep breath and leaned forward to put his elbows on the table. Everyone is gathering at Gamma Pavonis. Threats or no, the others still have a Dyson sphere to build. They won't halt everything while they march off to Sol. We want to be ready next time. I stared into space, nodding. Meanwhile, Riker has started building dreadnoughts at Sol, and I'm building a fleet in Epsilon Eridani. Ditto, Oliver and Alpha Centauri. We have the cloaking nailed now, so we'll be able to give them a harder time of it. The root problem, though, is still to produce enough ordnance to make a dent in the others' armada. The size problem is still overwhelming. This is all just a delaying action. Andrew shook his head morosely. As long as the others are always making the first move, we can never defeat them. All they have to do is huddle for a decade or two, rebuild, and we're back to square one. We have to take the fight to them. This is true, and you know damned well it's been the subject of many a moot. I glared at Andrew. I have an idea that I'm working on that might form a final solution, but I'm not sure yet if it's even feasible. And even if it turns out to be workable, it's a long game. Meanwhile, we're also trying to gear up to an invasion fleet. Maybe we can drop in on the others and pay our respects. Andrew's only answer was a predatory smile. End Book 2.
This has been an Audible Studios production of For We Are Many, Bobbyverse Book 2. Written by Dennis E. Taylor. Performed by Ray Porter. Producer, Mike Charzik. Copyright 2017, Dennis E. Taylor. Production copyright 2017 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.